time again. Hey, it's your host, Kevin Pollack. Welcome back to another episode of My Mrs. Maisel Pod. Thank all of you for writing to us at mymrsmaiselpod@gmail.com with your questions and comments, questions for anyone who ever worked on the show. I love to read them on the show, and I'm getting to as many as I can, so thank you all for sending those in today. Oh, man. Well, they're all special, but today's absurdly special because I'm speaking with Tony Shalhoub, the multi-award winning, so many awards, too many awards. He's just one of those awards guys. He gets nominated for everything and wins most of the time. And Tony today shares experiences and memories and insights from shooting the first two episodes of season two. In Paris. Yowza. Paris. Yeah, so a few of us got to go over to Paris to shoot. Not all of us, he said, still troubled and jealous. So Tony does share a lot, and there's so much to Tony's performances, as you've enjoyed. And so to hear him talk about some of those moments and what these moments mean to him and what this work means to him was a great joy of mine and now hopefully a great joy of yours to listen to. I just love talking with Tony. We hadn't met prior to Mrs. Maisel, which we talk about, the absurdity of that and why we have theories, why we were kept apart. And it's a bit of a love fest, this episode, and it's here for you now. Oh, yeah. Here now, as threatened, the multi-award-winning Tony Shalhoub. It's too many awards, right?
It is. It's a few too many now, Kev.
Yeah. Yeah, I put you in that highfalutin Mount Rushmore category with people like Alice and Janney, and there's a few others. Anytime they do anything, they get nominated for an award, whether it's TV or a play or something. The academies, the voting bodies love you and your work. You don't have to say anything in response. It's just a fact.
Well, it's an opinion. But,
Listen, you're doing great work and people are acknowledging it. First of all, I can't believe they kept you and I apart for so long.
I know. It's just a terrible thing.
I tell so many people that we met on this show, and they find that hard to believe. And then I explained to them that you had met my better half, Jamie, at, I think it was Bloomingdale's for Men, maybe, at the Beverly Center.
Yeah, I think we were both buying you something, I'm pretty sure.
Well, that would be amazing. She said she was in front of you. She was buying something. She turned around, lost her shit, and said, "You're Tony Shalhoub." And you said something funny, confirming.
And like something said, like, yes.
Yeah, that's right.
That's always funny.
And then she insisted on oversharing, letting you know she was buying something for me. She loves character actors. And your response, whether you remember or not, was, "Well, let Kevin pay for this then." Meaning your item.
Yes, I think I do remember that.
Yeah, which apparently I still owe you $172. But we'll get to that. So, Tony, I'm glad they let us finally meet. And, you know, I don't know if I remember telling you, but when they were casting the pilot, my agent did get a ring-a-ding that I was being shortlisted for the role of Abe.
Oh.
And the caveat was because no one believed the show could get Tony Shalhoub to do a supporting role, having carried his own show for so many, many seasons.
Oh, wow.
So they put together a short list in anticipation of you saying, go fuck yourself. So what, that my first question has always been, was it a difficult decision to take on what's insisted upon and now Emmy?
It was. And I wasn't going to take it, but then they told me that you were on the short list and I thought, I'll fuck you.
I'm not letting that happen. So yes.
I mean, I was, you know, we all just had that pilot to go on. The show obviously hadn't been picked up yet. And I was struck by the, you know, the size of the role of Abe in the pilot. It was really just, you know, a few scenes, you know, a flashback.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really kind of tend to, well, I guess I should say, I what I've learned over many decades of stumbling and, you know, stepping on landmines in this business, you know, your decisions really, my decisions really have to be made on just the quality of the material. And you gotta, you know, just let your ego, you have to, you know, just has to take a back seat. You gotta come to that at some point, you know?
Yeah.
I just love the material. The short answer is I just wanted to be in the room when these words were being spoken and when these characters were being, you know, formed and germinating.
Yeah.
I just thought, if this works, if this goes, if there's an audience for it besides me, you know, it seems like in all of these positions, all of these actors, all these characters, it feels like they're going to have room to really bloom and evolve. I think I just got that sort of sense when I was, examining the pilot. So I just thought, and then help too that my agents put me on the phone with Amy and Dan. Yep. Very early on. Had never met them, but you know, I knew about Gilmore Girls, of course, and I was just struck by how kind of easy they were to talk to, and they did reassure me that, you know, this was just the pilot and that the character would, you know, would expand as all the characters would. Somehow there was just something very genuine and unassuming in their tone of voice. And that was good enough for me.
Yeah, they mask it very well in the first meeting. I found that as well.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember shooting what would be episode 2 of season 1.
Right.
After the show had been picked up. And I remember asking you what your sense was when you were shooting it. And you said, you must have said this to other people because it's such a great line. Listen, I thought certainly the Jews who lived in the Upper West Side of New York would watch the show.
You know, within like 3-4 blocks of Zabar's, that would be the demographic of a certain age. You
know? Yeah. And so for season 4, it was quoted that we had 500 million hours viewed. Are you okay with that?
It's astonishing, isn't it? I'm happy. Yeah, I'm happy with that. I have no problem with that, Kev.
Okay, good. Have you traveled outside of the United States since working on this and heard from, or fans mentioned it while still in the United States who normally live in other countries?
Oh, sure.
I've had it a lot. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Well, you're a world traveler.
Well, it's people who live here or are here. We were just in New York, actually, at the Greek Kitchen. I think I told you about that place on 10th near 58th.
Oh, yeah.
And a family from Yugoslavia, maybe, came up to the table and said that they were here in New York on vacation and they were big Maisel fans. And, you know, I just laugh. I can't help but laugh every time it happens.
Amazing.
How do we enter these lives?
Well, certainly when we went to France to shoot the beginning of season 2 in Paris, you know, only after, how many, was it like 10 episodes in season 1? And, you know, it was like over there, people were already, you know, they were, of course, recognizing us and they were on board. It was like we were the honeymooners or something. It was really massive there. Around that time, after shooting in Paris, we traveled to Lebanon. It was my first trip to Lebanon. I wanted to see, you know, a place where my dad was from. This was, you know, a few years before the wheels completely fell off there. And there, too, there was a, you know, there was Maisel all the time. So definitely got the feeling that Amazon had rolled this out in the perfect way.
The global. Yeah, because they dropped between Thanksgiving and Christmas, I believe, of 2017. And then we went to work March. We're shooting season 2. Would it be March when you went to Paris?
It was March. Yeah, but I think that was
18, 19, 18. Must have been 18.
It had to have been 18 because it's when I was doing Van's visit. And that's right. That's right.
Yeah, because we would go on to the Catskills later in season 2. When I think the Tony nominations were announced while we were in the Cats, because there was some conversation about it that I'm remembering while yelling after Scoop Shalhoub, who loved the Catskills. Oh,
who
man.
Had it. And the crew gave him, this is our 9-year-old Golden Doodle, and the crew gave him his own director's chair with a low one so he could climb into it with his name embossed in the back there.
Not bad. Not a bad deal. Had you worked on camera in an American project in Paris prior?
I don't think so. No, I had visited Paris a couple of times, but I'd never worked there. It was the time. We had the time of our lives there, really.
Yeah.
Sorry you couldn't join us.
Well, yeah, me too. So I know my experience of shooting in another country is just such curiosity. How is this going to go?
Yeah.
How the crew is going to be different. But I'm very also curious what your experience was like having not shot in France before, or certainly Paris?
Well, that's a good question, because there was a lot of, kind of glee and giggling when we were hearing that we were going to be there for 3 weeks, because, you know, you always hear these stories about, in France, the crews, they only work 10 hours a day. Your days are a lot shorter than the ones here, 10 maximum. And lunch is like 2 hours, and there's wine at lunch. And we're like, wow, this is going to be great.
Yes.
And so, as with most things, the anticipation was a lot better than the reality. But I mean, it was fantastic. The crew was great. But we did not have 10-hour days, and we did not have wine at lunch. We had a little wine, after working hours.
Sure.
But, a little, half a glass here and there. But no, it wasn't that sort of fantasy that everybody, that people seem to paint talking about Europe.
Right.
It was a tough shoot in the sense it was an ambitious schedule, as Amy and Dan are, they always kind of lean that way. But damn, I recently watched these episodes, these first two of season two, in anticipation of talking to you today. And, It's astonishing, again, what they can do and how.
Yeah.
First, the plan is fantastic. The script is fantastic. The story is amazing. But what they then, how they kind of like make adjustments and improvise, on the day, it's amazing. They found this, there's a scene where Midge is walking on the street in the evening, and I think it's after the dinner where Abe blows up, and there's this little ragtag band on the sidewalk, and this older woman, and she's kind of doing this crazy little dance. And these are people, they just found them. They just stumbled on them.
Yeah.
And Amy stayed on that shot for a very long time. And then Midge walks through the frame. We see her walk away. And then the camera pans back to this band and this dancing woman that have nothing to do with the story,
right?
Except it's just that kind of delicious, unexpected, but perfect, flavor of Paris in 1959. Incredible.
Yeah. With the period cars, we have such a luxury in the States. I wonder how difficult it was to find those period cars in Paris. Probably the same, probably similar. There's people who collect them.
Yeah. And there's a lot of film and stuff shot there. They have to have access to those kinds of period things.
Yeah.
I would assume, the luxury of shooting in Paris is almost nowhere. I mean, you can go anywhere.
And it's beautiful.
It's just timeless. It's, you could be in the 1950s, you could be in the 1850s. It doesn't matter. You throw a couple of, people in the right clothes and a couple of vehicles in there, and boom, you're transported.
Yeah. And of course, all the wardrobe fittings for that work had been done in the States. You knew what sort of French beret you would be wearing. And then it seemed to me, knowing as little as I do, that you were shooting in practical sets. That is to say, real apartments and real cafes and real.
Oh, yes.
So no soundstage work at all in Paris?
Not that I remember.
That you were doing?
Not me. I mean, the first little apartment where we stumble across, that was all location. You know, the courtyard area, those massive doors that you always kind of go through into the courtyard. And that little walk-up was very small, very funky, and very, a challenge to shoot in because the space was so limited.
Yeah.
And then that gorgeous apartment on the Seine that Rose brings Abe to, with the idea that they're going to buy it and live there. That place really was an apartment for sale. It was empty. And there was actually discussion among a group of us. It's like, why don't we all just go in on it together and do it like a timeshare or something?
For goodness sake.
Amy and Dan included. We were just smitten by this place.
It was stunning. And they shot it beautifully.
Oh, my God. And there were mirrors all over this apartment. How they did this scene, tracking through one room into another without the crew or camera being caught in the mirrors, I still don't understand it.
I assume that was Jim McConkie
yes, it was, I believe.
Our brilliant Steadicam genius.
Yeah, it was Paris. The whole thing was just an absolute dream.
What about the little conveniences that we become so accustomed to in these formerly United States? So we're over there. Were there trailers? What was your on-set
I mean, we shoot on sound stages now, and we're rarely in our trailers because they set up chairs for us in a certain area. It's got to be a pretty big break for us to go back to our trailer.
Yeah, I think we had, as I remember, in most of these locations, we just had like, you know, a kind of green room setup where they would just acquire another space for background or for actors would hang out. And so don't recall there being actual trailers out there. And all of these little places were, even though they weren't massive places, they were charming. And of course, the food, forget about it. You can't go wrong with, I mean, you just have like lunch was, you know, even though there wasn't a wine, unless you brought your own, there was
French caterer.
Just bread and cheese. I'm good. You know, what else do you need?
Yeah, a little different over there, the bread and cheese.
Very different.
And did all the cast and some of the crew stay in the same hotel?
Yes, a lot of people opted to stay in the hotel. My wife and I, she traveled with me, of course, and we opted for an Airbnb in the Marais district. Best move ever. Yeah. You know, we were like the hotel was covered by production, and I'm sure it was less than the hotel. It had to be, cause even though it was like three bedrooms. We couldn't find a one bedroom. You know, we were kind of late to the party. We couldn't find a one bedroom, as I remember, at that time in the area we wanted to be in. So then we said, oh, we'll look for two bedrooms. And then we couldn't find. So then we actually ended up with a three bedroom that was still cheaper than the hotel. And our, you know, our friends came over from the States and hung with us for about a week. And,
oh, great.
You know, it was fantastic. We had would buy some, you know, groceries and have our own little breakfast there. It was really, really cool.
Yeah.
And very private too. You know, in a hotel, you're,
yes.
When you're in a production, you walk through the lobby and people are kind of like, meh.
Yeah.
But this was so, so serene and low key.
Yeah. You have a home.
Totally right.
Yeah. I shot in London in October, which I'm sure I've told you at least two dozen times.
Yeah.
And got an Airbnb, the same thing, just to have a home and all the accoutrements. Yeah. The depending on a hotel for those things is good for just a couple days, I think.
Yeah. I mean, but when you're 3 weeks, you know, you want to have a plate. You want to go open a refrigerator and not just see little bottles of alcohol, you know, and a Toblerone.
Toblerone. Nice touch. Even though I'm guessing you still got some little bottles in your Airbnb.
Mostly wine, but when in Paris, as they say.
Yeah. And now we bring our own crew, but there must have been some crew that were Parisian.
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
ADs, you know, the ADs and seconds, I think, were from there. And my transpo guy was really great. I had this guy, name happened to be Pierre.
Oh.
He was very, you know, sort of young, great-looking, young Parisian guy. Very cool. Who happened to, and he just like picked us up in his little, it was like a sports car or something, you know. It was great. And he also had, what do you call it? You know, like Wi-Fi in his car. What is that? It's that thing. You can just hook up your phone. You know, it's great. And he was terrific. He took us around even when we weren't working and showed us different places. We really, really got to be, you know, pals there.
How long has he been living with you and Brooke in New York now? You tried to take him back.
She did. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing. I was wondering if some of the crew or some of the day players expressed interest in working in America. I wondered about that, you know, because when you're there that long, 3 weeks, you do get to know people and you do. There is a sense of family, even though our family's on the road.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, not that they were.
I don't know that I didn't get that sense as much because I really got this feeling that we had like the first tier people.
Yeah.
And those people are always going to be in demand and their jobs are. You know, they're pretty secure. So,
yeah, they're booked up.
Yeah, yeah. They were super efficient and, you know, warm and they got the job. I mean, all you have to do is look at these episodes and you can see that they got the job done.
Yeah. So you rewatched the first two episodes that do involve your time in Paris, but so many scenes that you guys were not in until episode two of season two when the Weissmans come back home to New York.
Yes.
So watching those two episodes again, even the opening with Midge and the switchboard in the bowels of B. Altman, right?
That never, ever gets old. I remember it really, really being brilliant. And then I watched it again.
After today, years actually, off, yeah.
Yeah. And I just thought, how do they pull that off? There's no there are no cuts. There's no nothing. There's just magic happening. The choreography, this timing. I don't even want to think about how long and arduous that rehearsal period was. But
yeah, I've talked to others on the podcast, cast members, about those 8 page wonders, as we call them, regardless of what the actual page count was, just to round up or down. In terms of the amount of time one rehearses and then shoots, how many takes versus all the coverage. I mean, every now and then we'll get a guest director who does more coverage, and I can just see the cast members just look up and go,
oh, here we go.
Here we go. It's old timey film. Or the kind of filming that's happening on every other single television show and movie.
Yeah. Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah. Yeah. So is there anything that, going back to season 2, episode 1, anything other than that switchboard scene? We've got Susie in her apartment. She wakes up to the phone.
Yeah. So good. I mean, it's almost like those episodes are so, I don't know another word for it. They're just so dense. Yeah. You know, they're each scene is full and advancing the story and challenging the actors and, you know, kind of moving the needle every time, scene after scene. And then there's a scene where I think it's episode 2. I'm thinking about when Midge comes back to New York, and there's that scene when Susie's in the bathtub having smoked a joint and Bailey comes in, Imogene comes in.
Yeah, that is episode 2.
I mean,
that's just,
all of these scenes are just.
Yeah, it is. It's gold. Also, the idea of taking Susie out of her element and putting her in the Weissman's apartment in their bathtub.
Yeah,
it's just so expansive of the universe. Right?
It's the prince and the pauper kind of thing. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Yes. And you mentioned Rose, the character of Rose, and what Marne was doing in those Paris scenes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. She, when Abe and Midge end up in Paris after doing some math, that math back in the Weissman apartment of Abe somehow being oblivious and yet completely believable the way it was portrayed, the confounded, right? And then showing up there and Rose's response, I loved it so much, and it made so much sense for Abe to not last very long in this idyllic setting. And what do you mean you're not coming home? So then to pick up an episode 2 of season 2, where Abe is just flourishing, he's got cronies.
Yeah,
you know, they,
it's romantic. They have a romantic kind of second honeymoon almost.
Truly, truly, yeah. But I love the moment in episode 1 when Mid says, "I've missed you, Mama." And Rose.
Oh my God. I was just thinking about that. It just, every time, it's just a punch in the gut. And she says, "I've missed me too."
Yeah.
I mean, and Marne is just so kind of centered there. It's killer. I mean, that's, you know, it speaks volumes about, you know, the role, the women of that time and in of our time of having to kind of, you know, just take on these expected roles and sacrifice their time and their skill, their talents and their happiness, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And it was also amazing to me that they got to Rose's journey through that world in the beginning of season 2, where they spent pretty much all of season 1 with a young woman struggling through separation, probable divorce, 2 kids. Coming into her own for the first time, it feels like, and what that experience is and that trajectory through the first season. And then right at the outset of season 2, we started a parallel path with Rose. And I don't think anyone was ready for it, not just Abe. As an audience member, it was like, what is happening?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And as you mentioned, Rose finding herself and needing to find herself was so ambitious.
Yeah. And all of a sudden we become invested in that character. She's not just the mother of our main character. She's got her own, you know, struggles and her own pain and her own deep, deep feelings of, you know, being confined and constricted and kind of in a way deep grieving her lost youth and her, you know, when she was a student and when she traveled and when she was well, liberated, frankly, for lack of a better word. She was of a certain class growing up where she could do that and she could be that. And to see her try to, you know, kind of yearning and struggling to recapture that.
Yeah, and instigated by her daughter's journey.
Yeah.
And the character of Rose feeling left out. You're keeping secrets. I'm not needed.
Yeah.
Which sparks that drive.
And that's a beautiful scene after the restaurant scene. And, you know, the second or third time Abe storms out. It's basically all my character does. So it's like, get agitated and storm out. But they're on the street and Midge is reprimanding her mother. You know, this is your husband. You can't just leave him. You have a responsibility. And Marge just says, well, look who's talking.
Yeah.
You know, she walked away from her marriage or you know, didn't fight for it. And that's what sort of, again, the beauty and the kind of wisdom of this show. It isn't so simple. It's all complicated stuff.
So complicated. Each relationship to themselves, like when you mentioned Midge not fighting for it. We have that moment in season one where Joel character pretty much screws up everything and everyone's happiness.
Yeah.
Simply because he's miserable. Talk about storming out. But when he comes crawling back finally, which the audience thought they wanted, we have Midge saying, no, you left, you're out. And Abe struggled with that when she has that conversation with him in season one. So,
but even Abe has to, as frustrating as it is for him and as unconventional as it is, this situation, he's conflicted because he sees that, okay, on the one hand, I want her to have a secure, stable marriage and really a family. On the other hand, she's fighting for herself. She's being an advocate for, she's not taking any shit. And that he's weighing the balance and her strength and her desire to be autonomous and carve her own way in his mind outweighs the other. It was a very difficult thing for him to make peace with, but it speaks to this family. It's like the Maisels too, like Moish and Shirley. You know, they're all fighters, these people. They you know what I mean? They don't roll over. They keep, because of, you know, for whatever reason, because of their upbringing, because they've been, you know, came through the war and you know, being all of that. I mean, they've had incredibly, we see them living kind of cushy lives, but their struggle has been really, really huge and severe. So I sort of see that. I see Abe, I want to think, I mean, my subtext is that, you know, Abe sees in Midge this fighter that he kind of would love to sort of think of himself as, I spawned that. I fostered that. Even though it kind of flies in the face of, you know, conventional wisdom and conventional lifestyles, he's created or he's helped to foster a kid who's tough and proud.
Yes.
And proud in the right way, in the sense of having, you know, feeling like she has self-worth.
And you can't help but know, even from a writer's standpoint, that Abe is then inspired to follow his own passions and journeys, breaking away from ultimately.
As we see in late season three and early in season four.
Right.
Yeah. And in a way, I really believe that he's inspired by her, as Rose is in a way.
Yep.
And they're all kind of taking their, I feel like they're almost like they're given permission to take these larger risks and upend their complacent lives.
Yeah. You want your children to thrive, right?
Yeah.
And then the moment they do, they can be very scary.
Well, yeah, you want them to, you don't want them to struggle too much and become, you know, ground down and defeated. On the other hand, you want them to be proactive and create, you know, inventive and resilient. And so
resilient, experience defeat, get back up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
in this second episode, in fact, the Joel character has quit his job and we see him working at Maisel and Roth, which Moish, we sense that he might have wanted that, but has to question it. and even gets to the point of, how do I know you're going to stick it out? When the Joel character is, I'm not leaving till I fix this place. And it's not something Moish wanted. It's barely something he welcomes. And then the sit down with them at the bar is pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, and again, I go back to this thing, you know, you and I, you know, we came up, or I'm a little older than you, but, you know, our fathers, you know, they wanted, they worked really hard. They carved a path for themselves, and they wanted more for their kids, right? Sometimes they wanted their kids to follow in the, you know, their footsteps and whatever, the business, the family. But most often they wanted to, you know, they wanted their kids to do better and to, you know, and I wonder about that. I wonder what Moish gave up and you know, as successful as he is, as a self-made man that he is, as much of that as he is, you know, what were his kind of secret? Oh God, if only I didn't have to do this, I could do that. Sort of, you know, maybe he'd be sitting in a tree and, you know, in Malibu playing a flute or something, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But my point is that the sacrifices that this generation made, and then, you know, for their children and all that. And so I think I love that scene. I just watched a scene with you and him and then in the bar, and you just sort of get that sense behind your eyes where you're really thinking, oh boy, you don't want this friggin' job, man. You know, I mean, it's whether you could stick with it or not. Do I really want this for you?
Yeah.
Sure. Would I love to have you as my right hand? Yes. But do you want to be in this place with these, dealing with these mad people?
We get that question evolves and has a resolve in season 3.
Right. And that's where you pass on the money, right?
Some savings and get the fuck out of here. Yeah.
Pursue your thing.
But that's the thing about Amy and Dan. They keep expanding not only the Maisel universe, but each character's journey, propelling it forward. There's no sitting back. Even if it's Shirley, you know, we meet her, she's got pickles in her purse, but, and these books that she's keeping in episode 2 of season 2 is so funny. But it is a chance to see her role in the Maisel Roth world, which,
yes, fighter.
As damaged as it was, she was not going to let her man, you know, go down. And also a little bit of oblivious. Yeah, there were some problems. I'm not sure. The tax guy came in, he looked, it was fine. Well, I paid him. That's why.
Yeah, but you know, that's, again, she's a fighter. She's, you could say a lot of things about Shirley, but Shirley is no, you know, she is super observant. You know, she may look like she's a, you know, beat her two behind, but she is seeing everything. And she knows that she is working, you know, you're in America in this period, you know, you're in business. Hey, there's stuff happening around you that isn't always on the up and up. You have to play the game or you're going to freaking die in the, you know what I mean? You got to, she sees what's going on out there.
Yes.
Is it a little bit of, is there fudging? Yeah, but that's what everybody's doing to make it work.
Right.
I'm not, you know, being an advocate for that, but I'm just saying this is the world that these people have to, you know, the waters that they have to navigate through. It's,
yeah,
I mean, it's funny. And she managed to make it funny and kind of endearing and wacky. And
yeah. Yeah. As arch as each character gets on occasion, there is a center within them and a grounding that happens organically through the writing and storytelling that never fails them. You know, there's never character assassination on this show, which is almost historical. At some point, you know, for a bit or a gag or a,
oh yeah,
you know, some
somebody character gets thrown under the bus.
Well, it's like a, it's fine, it doesn't matter, it's not important, we don't need to answer that question.
Yeah. And then nobody will remember it next week. They'll forget.
Amy and Dan seem very, very rooted in the honesty of plot holes, but also character spine and reality.
Yeah.
This is pretty amazing to play. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, and I'm happy we are, because as it turns out, life is way harder than we were told. You hear the words mental health used a lot today, and there's a reason. People, myself included, need help now and again. Whether it's pressures and stress at work or, you know, family drama or relationships that are undermining any hope you have at a healthy and positive daily life. Maybe you need help trusting yourself to make decisions that align with your actual values. That too, is like anything else, the more you practice it, the easier it gets. I've had dark days like anyone else. It happens. It develops over time. And, you know, it shows up one day as a dark, destructive force inside of you, maybe. And for me, I just needed someone to talk to, a trained professional, someone who will never judge or belittle for just not feeling right. If you're thinking about it, or you're done thinking about it, and you want to do something about it, please consider heading over to BetterHelp.com. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, suited to your schedule. You fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime at no additional charge. Let therapy be your map with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Maisel and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Maisel. How has your experience been in terms of them directing? So the two episodes in Paris, did they take turns? Did each one direct one? Did Amy do both?
I remember? think they well, we shot it as, you know, we cross-boarded it. So we were shooting both episodes, you know, simultaneously.
Yeah.
So I think they were, if I remember correctly, so long ago.
Yeah.
It seemed like they were tag teaming, you know, and coming in and out and in and out.
Right.
But I like that. I like cross-boarding. I mean, we did it in the Catskills, as you know. Mm-hmm. We were shooting three episodes, like a 3-hour movie. So cross-boarding, you know, three different stories. And that was challenging. You really had to keep it in your head where you were in the.
Especially for us who don't really know what's coming.
Well, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Normally. Know. Cross-boarding for you folks at home that don't have time to Google search. If they have a location like we did either in Paris or in the Catskills where you can't spend the whole season there, nor do you want to. But you're going to spend more than one episode. So you will take scenes in the same location, that location being used over multiple episodes, and you will shoot all the scenes from all the various episodes in that location out of context.
Out of sequence and out of
certainly context. Out of sequence and no context. So the actors, we do spend a lot of time saying, Where are we now? Which episode is this? Yeah. It'll be tagged on our wardrobe when we get dressed that morning, but you can only pay attention so much to that. And certainly the dialogue that we learned the night before or relearned, it would have indicated what episode it was. But still, there is a disconnect that naturally occurs. Fortunately for the Paris stuff, it was only the two episodes, and it was the first two. And it was a journey for those characters that took place.
Yeah.
Really, did we map out the time, how long Rose and Abe were actually in Paris together? Was that in the fictitious world?
As I remember, I think it was somewhere between like 10 days and 2 weeks or something
right.
like that.
That makes
long
sense.
Long enough so that they were, you know, really familiarizing themselves with the, you know, their neighborhood, their, you know, the places they ate, long enough for her to, you know, go to these museums, find this apartment, the new apartment.
Yeah.
The desired apartment. And long enough for them to do things together and to do things apart.
Sure.
Which I thought was so smart because you really, you know, I think it would have been sort of unrealistic and corny had it just been, oh, googly eyes and fun Paris things
yeah,
together.
That's, I mentioned you and Abe and his cronies was so rich and wonderful. And then Abe and Rose would get back together over dinner that she horribly made.
And they would tell each other about their day.
Yes.
And that's what could be better, you know?
We got a sense that wasn't happening at home much anymore. Yeah. And even the way the two characters tucked into that much smaller bed than at home and bon nuit, and I love you, or an version of that. And his reply is, you're a horrible cook. You know, there's with big smiles and nothing but love. Even at one point, Abe asks Simone, the new dog, giving it a morsel from dinner. Can you tell?
What did mommy make here?
Is fish or chicken? All of those little nuances, you know, they're such.
Yeah. Oh, he goes, well, that's what's so great about that. He goes from wanting to kill this dog.
Yeah.
When he first sees it, of wanting to kick it down the stairs, to wanting to, you know, to feeding it at his, you know,
the dog represented the extension of his anger towards his wife to have landed and instantly made it her home. And it included this dog.
Yeah. His dog. Replacement, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. The dog represented a lot. Yes.
I love that she pulls the dog out at the restaurant too.
Oh.
When they bring the steak tartare. I mean, the fact that she, know, there's just something so perfect that she's there. She is sitting with her daughter and her husband that she hasn't seen in a while. And her priority is the dog. It's fantastic.
It's so rich and real. She's taken on a responsibility, and she's also treating a very nuanced and subtle like a visitor.
Oh, yeah.
Initially, until she shows him the apartment, I think. Before that, he's just visiting. And so, yeah, the dog would definitely have precedent and her focus as a responsibility and a priority.
Priority, absolutely.
Yeah. Boy, the Frank and Nikki stuff coming into Susie's life, the two mobbed up guys who take her for a short walk on a long pier, and we think it's over. And those scenes are just so great, too.
So good, especially that subway scene is gold.
Oh.
They discover that she's from Rockaway.
Yeah.
And then take her home for a meal. Is that place still there? You know, we burned it down. Uh-huh. it's just a throwaway. It's fantastic.
And ended up taking her home for the meal. And
yeah,
ultimately, that's when the decision's made. I guess we're not going to kill you. You know, it's just so perfectly played by all parties involved. But Alex's choices of how Susie is truly afraid.
Yeah.
These guys. That's what ultimately brings us into the reality of these scenes and the actual stakes, as opposed to, hey, these mobster guys are funny, you know, with their banter and the thing, and hey, you're not too bad. But it's her abject fear in her eyes, chosen and played so beautifully by also a multi-Emmy award-winning actress, that carries the day. Yeah. Yeah. Just such a extraordinary welcome back to season two. Those first two episodes were really great.
Oh, man. So good.
Well, you just finished watching episode two, so I'm wondering if there's anything in there. When she was telling him about the Rodin Museum, then ultimately they go in that extraordinary montage. That's one of their stops. And they're shopping in the marketplace together before they stop on a little bench with a couple glasses of wine and just a baguette and a wedge of cheese. And he has this knife that he wants to show her and use that we're also left assuming he was a recent purchase. But the details, as storytellers and filmmakers, I don't know how much you caught of the background people, the performers. There's one little group of what seems to be mid to late teens playing a game of some kind that we have no idea what the game is, but they're super enthusiastic about it. It's like on top of what would look like a pickle barrel or something. I don't even understand what I was seeing because I hadn't seen it before.
Oh, I have to go back.
But the specificity of that was just beautiful.
Yeah.
And then when Abe and Rose come across the people at night along the Seine.
Oh, man.
And dance together. Yeah. I remember there was a big photograph of that when the team came back from Paris that was in the production office. And those of us that didn't go got a chance to see that. And just, it was all right there.
Yeah.
What were they doing? I see what they were doing. They were making magic. They were somehow making a period film as if it were made in the late 50s. Yeah.
It was moving watching, especially, you know, that scene on the Seine ends with a wide shot of Notre Dame, Notre Dame in the background. And that was pre-Vire, of course. I mean, it all is just so much has happened in the years since we started this. So much has occurred in the world and to the world. And things that have seemed like they've been there forever and were unalterable.
Mm.
And now everything is not. Everything is different. And it's a bit of sort of heart tug there, too.
Yeah. Well, my friend, I don't want to take up more of your time. I want to thank you immensely for taking a look back and sharing some of the insights from your experience. You know, we only have our own. And so it's one of the things I'm hoping to present to fans of the series is, you know, I had Bill Groom on and and Cindy Tolan talking about some of the great people who've joined us, and Donna, our genius wardrobe designer, is coming on. So many of the people behind the camera as well, and everyone's insight, you know, is so individual. So thank you for sharing yours.
It was fun to go down memory lane with you there.
Yeah. Hopefully we can tap into a couple of memories from maybe season 3 or 4 and ultimately 5, should we finish shooting it.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. Well, great, pal. I will see you on set soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Love to the family and you, and stay well, please. And yeah, thanks, man.
We'll talk soon.
There you have it, the wonderful Tony Shalhoub. Oh, come on. Are you serious? I mean, there's no way not to smile when he talks. That was my problem. My face hurt. The whole time we're talking, or I'm listening, I'm just smiling. The whole conversation. Smiling, laughing, smiling. Yeah, my face hurt. I hope yours does too after listening to that. Sorry. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks my whole heart to Tony Shalhoub for sharing all of that. Hey, something was brought to my attention on the socials. Kitty Bruce, the only daughter of Lenny Bruce, who's so celebrated and geniusly and Emmy award-winningly performed on the Maisel Show by the great Luke Kirby. Kitty Bruce needs your help. Yeah. She's sort of devoted her life to helping others with alcohol and drug abuse the way her father suffered. And not too long ago, she has suffered her own medical issues and needs our help. If you want to hear more about her and her work and what you can do to help interest you, head on over to givebutter.com/Kitty Bruce. There's sort of a GoFundMe situation set up. But even if you just want to know more about her, you can find a whole bunch of information about Kitty Bruce and her work online. But as I said, she needs our help, and I wanted to mention that here. So God bless you, Kitty Bruce, and you as well, fine listeners. Continue to write to us if you would, mrsmaiselpod@gmail.com. And hey, let's open up the mailbag, shall we? Yeah, here we go. Today's fan mail comes from Steffi, all the way from Cologne, Germany. Ah, look at that. Steffi writes, "Hey Kevin, Steffi from Cologne, Germany, here with a question. During one of my rewatches of the show, I noticed that in a lot of scenes, especially the scenes where the whole Maisel and Weissman families get together, or also at the stage deli, there is food on the table and each character's plate. Are you really eating during those scenes? How does it work for continuity if there are multiple takes of a scene and the actor has to take a big bite of a sandwich, for example? Do you get a new sandwich each time you have to do another take? And what happens to all the leftovers? Sorry if the question is a little weird. Maybe I was just very hungry when this crossed my mind. I'm really enjoying your podcast and can't wait for the next episode to come out. Lots of love, Steffi, Cologne, Germany." Well, these questions are so delicious that I couldn't think of a cast member more suited to answer than today's guest. So here now, master, multi-award winner Tony Shalhoub, to answer Steffi's questions.
Hello, Steffi. Tony Shalhoub here. No, we're not really eating in these scenes. We're actors, we're professionals. We're very, very disciplined. We know how to, you know, take small bites, because we have to do take after take. So it's not really a problem. Sometimes, if you really have to take a bite of something, there's a spit bucket provided between takes, so you really don't have to really actually swallow or anything. But I sometimes do these scenes for, you know, several hours at a time. You know, the biggest challenge is the continuity. Taking a bite on a certain line and picking up the fork, putting down the fork at the same time in every take. As far as the leftovers, most of that food Kevin takes and puts in a freezer he has in his dressing room or trailer. I'm guessing he donates it to soup kitchen or food pantry, something like that. Although, if I had to bet on it, I imagine he just takes it home. But I hope that answers your question. Thanks for writing in, and thanks for watching.
This is your host, Kevin Pollak, thanking you. I'll see you in my dreams. Until then, be kind to each other.
Okay, closing credits time. My Mrs. Maisel pod was created by me, your host, Kevin Pollack, research writer, producer, Jamie Fox, and our engineer, recording, post-production producer genius is Ken Plume. My Mrs. Maisel pod is brought to you by the fine folks at Q-Code. Q-Code. Sounds like something, doesn't it? Oh, lastly, you should know, I'm told by legal to make this crystal clear, that my Mrs. Maisel pod was not sanctioned in any way, shape, or form by Amazon Prime, nor the show's creators, Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino, although I feel the need to mention I did get their blessing. Okay, good. That should save me some legal.
Everyone needs a break from the real world. That's why we played games as kids, and that's why we should play games as adults. I'm Troy LaValle.
And I'm Joe O'Brien. And back in 2015, we started a podcast called The Glass Cannon Podcast, a show made up of comedians and actors playing a fantasy role-playing game.
And now is the perfect time to start listening because we just started a brand new story.
It's basically Lord of the Rings meets Game of Thrones meets X-Files.
Search for The Glass Cannon Podcast on your podcast app of choice. Hey, life is hard, so come play pretend with us.